It's not a hard thing to do, but you are supposed to do it if you are going to owe more than $1,000 in taxes. And it's just what your employer would be doing if you were employed, but now you're your own employer, so you have to do it.
Hello and welcome to the Musician Toolkit, episode number 69. My name is David Lane, and it is great to be with you once again. Since today's episode includes the topic of planning, I want to begin with a topic that I'm going to be mentioning in the next several episodes for sure, in addition to probably a few polls now and then in my Instagram stories, and that's at David Lane Music. Unless there is truly something unforeseen and disruptive, this podcast will present episode 100 when we get to November 11th, assuming I counted correctly. That's more than half a year away, but I do intend to look at all aspects of this podcast to rethink how it should look going forward. I do have some shorter solo episodes in the near future, so I'll take more time then to elaborate on what I mean by all of this. But what I'll say for now in each of the next several weeks is that I want to make informed decisions regarding the topics of each episode. So let's just look at the three previous episodes, for example. There's an episode of me talking about music history. Then there's an episode with a guest, Kate Warren, and we're talking about the French horn. Then there's last week's episode about 25 essential classical pieces that you should know. And since February, I have had multiple episodes all about goals, and I've had many episodes about practice strategies. I've got a variety of different topics coming up in the next few weeks. And then there's today's episode, which is about business for independent music teachers. So my question for you on this episode and on any of the past episodes is this. Would you like more episodes like this, or would you like fewer episodes like this? Please go to davidlanemusic.com, fill out the contact form, and send it to me. Let me know. You can also send me a message on Instagram at davidlanemusic or on Facebook at davidmlanemusic. It's really important that you let me know this, because by your silence does not let me know. And in probably the case of planning, I may take your silences to mean fewer episodes like this. So if it's something you value for sure, make sure that you let me know. Thank you for doing this. This really helps me figure out a question that I'm wrestling with, and that is, who really is this podcast for? That's a question I want to figure out and inform how I further develop this podcast. Now, who is this podcast for is not a hard question on an episode-by-episode basis. Today's episode is definitely worth listening to if you are an independent teacher or plan to be an independent teacher. My guest is Andrea Miller of Music Studio Startup, a coaching service for music teachers. Music Studio Startup is also the name of her podcast, which has been going pretty steadily since 2018. Today, we're talking about getting set up properly as a business, including whether or not you should look into becoming an LLC, the things you want to do if you become an LLC. And since this episode is coming out on April 8th, we are 1 week from tax day, as of the day of this episode's release. And so we're going to be talking about taxes and paying quarterly estimates, and also some information about the beneficial ownership information form that you may need to fill out if you're already an LLC. And then some helpful practices to having a successful career, including quarterly goals, you know, one of my favorite topics, but also the importance of following up with prospective clients. It's a fairly long but very informative conversation. So let's get to it. Here's my chat with Andrea Miller. Andrea, it's great to talk to you once again. It's the third time we've talked, and I have been in a different place each time. I think you've repeated locations.
Possibly, yeah. Yes. If it's been in the last 2 years, been in the same place, 3 years, I guess, three whole years in the same place.
Right. So we met at NAMM in Anaheim, California, in 2022, I think, is when that was. Sounds about right. It's hard to believe it hasn't been two full years since then, but there's been two more NAMMs in Anaheim since then, because they're trying to get back on schedule.
Interesting method for doing it. I wouldn't have thought of that.
Yeah, and then we chatted also on Zoom. You know, just obviously with no microphone, nothing recorded. While you were at home and I was at home, but I have since moved, so I'm in a different location. But it is great to talk with you once again. So we're averaging once a year, at least we should at least maintain that, if not increase that.
All right, sounds good.
Tell us a little bit about what it is you do, and I know that's a lot that you do, but I know we're going to mention, the music studio startup is kind of how you help other teachers, so we're going to be talking about the business of teaching. The business side mm-hmm. of teaching is primarily what we're going to talk about, but just what are some of the ways that you make a living as a musician and as a teacher and as a coach?
Yeah, so it's been a lot of things over the years. I guess I haven't ever exclusively been a teacher. I'm a person who just likes to do a lot of different things and right. dabble. So I guess the most when I was most exclusively teaching, I had 35 students and I ran a multi-teacher music studio, but I also was a church musician at the time too. So just because I like to dabble. But now my studio is fairly small, and then I run Music Studio Startup, which is one-on-one and group coaching for music teachers. And I have a podcast with that, Music Studio Startup, and a membership and courses and all those things. And then I also am the, technically my job title is integrator, but it's like a director of operations role for a piano retailer. And that's my most full-time gig right now. All three parts, the teaching, the business coaching, and the director of operations roles really are well aligned, which is why I do all of them and just all support each other.
It just occurred to me, I've never asked you before, is piano your instrument?
It yes. is. Okay. It is. I played a little violin when I was in middle school and just didn't stick with me like piano did. So
I wonder what the odds are if I just randomly ask teachers I'd never talked to before, but I know that they're a teacher, what is your instrument? If I said, is it piano, what percentage of the time would that answer be yes?
I feel like 70%, but yeah. I don't know. I'd be curious.
It's like, say piano or voice, I feel like you've covered a lot of it. Although it seems like there's a lot more piano teachers than voice teachers, which kind of surprises me because, piano requires a lot more investment in your instrument. So
it's kind of funny that that's such a common instrument. I don't really get it when you think.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe, 100 years ago, even 50 years ago, every piano had a home, and it's not like that anymore. But it's surprising that the piano has stuck as like the primary first instrument. Really,
I don't remember what I was listening to an audiobook, and they all kind of run together, so I can't remember which one I heard it in, because I've listened to a lot of ones that are similar, but it mentioned a trivia, and I never trust just one source, but it did strike my interest of how there were more homes had pianos than they had cars or something like that and a while back, and it might have been some other thing. It was like something that everybody has a lot of now. Mm-hmm. And it might have been televisions, it might have been cars, but all right, I feel really bad now. But it was something as common as, say, cars or television would be today.
Wow, and microwave? Maybe microwave.
Yeah. but whatever it was, it might have even been like bathrooms. It was there were more pianos in homes than there were bathrooms or something. But it was something super common today, and that was just how things were valued back then. So mm-hmm. it probably has there was a push to get pianos in homes, and so pianos have been the way that people have learned, and it's just been such an instrument. Plus I've talked about piano quite a bit. It's its advantages, but I don't want to take too much of your time rehashing that. Also, in all the stuff that you did, you do have a podcast, Music Studio Startup, and I've enjoyed listening to that. I can't say that I've heard every episode, but I've heard a lot of episodes, and we'll definitely encourage people to go check that out. We'll mention it again as we go. But let's just talk about so teaching business. So this is an interesting way that we're recording this. We're recording this a little bit early before it's going to be released, and it's on a mathematical day. It's Pi Day. It's 314.
Yes, it is.
And it's going to come out exactly a week before April 15th, which is a tax day. So talking about numbers and talking about business. So this episode is kind of designed, or our main conversation is going to be, if you're looking into teaching, or maybe you have been teaching for a while, either way, you want to be thinking like a business. And you've had a lot of experience in helping teachers do exactly that, even from the very beginning, to be thinking about, you're not just, it's great that you want to teach everybody, but you also want to make a living from it. And, you want to make it in such a way that you're not being perceived as a hobbyist, that it's not just a hobby. And so there's some things that we need to do. So I'm just going to start this very generic and kind of let you lead. We'll just say three important things that you, up to three, whatever number you want to do. What are some important things that most aspiring professional teachers neglect when they get started?
Yeah. The first one I would say is building someone else's studio instead of your own. Mm. And what I mean by that is there are a lot of strong opinions out there, and people, you see them on Instagram or TikTok or Facebook or wherever. There's always going to be someone or many someones who will tell you how you should build your studio, and so many ideas and how to do it to their end. But you have to build your own studio because you're the one who has to sleep with it at night and just be satisfied by it. So I just really encourage teachers to start by getting in touch with their own vision and values around their teaching and studio, and then filter all those ideas through what they want to build, rather than just following this shiny object that someone recommends and this shiny object, because you can drive yourself nuts doing that.
Right. It's funny when you say, you can go on social media and find all kinds of people telling you, you should do it this way. And it's always, I think what we should always take from that is that this person is telling you that they found a way that worked for them. They're not telling you that that's the only way. I won't call out by name. There's someone that I follow that also coaches teachers on Instagram. And a long while back, they had a post that kind of really discouraged anybody from teaching when they didn't have, they hadn't studied how to teach. And, I kind of took that a little personally, just because I didn't go to school to learn how to teach. And pretty sure, even up to the day that I graduated with my final degree, that I had no intention of teaching. But there was an opportunity presented to me to teach, and I tried it and discovered, surprise, I liked it. And I did not know how to teach when I taught my first lesson, but I learned how to teach as I go. And, dismiss any idea that there's just that one thing that you have to do.
Mm-hmm. And it's same with are you teaching one-on-one lessons or group lessons, and someone will be a strong voice in one camp, or do you do monthly tuition or by the lesson tuition? And I think business cases can be made for any of those models, and so you really just it's what you want, and then you want to make that work. But there's so many ways to build a sustainable studio.
So after at least a decade of charging a flat rate per month, this year, and I told my students, I'm going to evaluate this after 1 year, and I may change it again. Mm-hmm. but I am charging per lesson this year. It's just charging per week. Now my rate is a little higher, and I'm kind of, we're so far so good going into March. I'm kind of secretly worried that maybe there's going to, some students might take advantage of this and take a lot of time off, and I may have to handle this. But I'm trusting the word of other teachers who have done this, that this works pretty well if you have what I have, which is an automated payment system. So now, I would have never done this if I had to take checks all the time or cash all the time. But, having a system like Fonds, for example, where you can get the student's parent or get the student themselves, if they're an adult, to put in the payment system to commit to a weekly time, and then put a 24-hour cancellation policy on it, or something like that. Well, first of all, I like the fact that it just takes out of the question, when are we going to make up this lesson? Even as clearly as you can explain it in your policies, it's just one of those things. But at the same time, I'm thinking, when the summer gets here, am I going to miss having a flat fee, for each month? We'll find out. But teachers have made both of those ways work before, so it's not really a thing, that you have to concern yourselves with. But I just thought I'd, just mention that as an example. You can have that. I have one student, she's not on my payment system. She's not on Fonds, but she pays, and I've never asked her to do this, but she pays 6 months at a time with cash. And she told me when she did it the first time, she goes, I want to make sure I'm committed to this and not giving up after a month. And, she's a small business owner, so, you can kind of see where that comes from. And I really like that determination. And so might that be something that I don't know if this is common with teachers or not, but I know in a lot of things, people give up too soon. So should we have a longer time, a trial period when we're trying something like this, trying a studio? What would you advise as far as that goes?
I go back to why I make this the first thing is building your business and not someone else's. Because if you've given some thought to what is your vision for your studio and what values do you want to, pass on to your students, and that value might be, I want them to be committed to this. I think it takes 6 months for someone to decide whether or not they like it, and I want to make sure that they've got that commitment. Then that can inform your policies. That can inform your payment structure. You might require new students to pay 6 months up front and existing students to pay by the lesson or something. There are all sorts of creative things you can do. And I don't think there's one right way. It's what are you trying to accomplish with the way you set up your studio and your policies and your payment plans and all of that.
Right. And, and by the way, here's just a little helpful hint for everybody. You can change your mind.
Yeah. And yes. I love how you frame what you're doing. Like, I'm doing this experiment for this year. I might change it next year. And yeah. I'm so curious to hear how the summer goes with your students and what you notice in the income drop. And if you notice an income drop, who knows, you might even see a rise. Students might take two lessons a week or something in the summer if they view it as an a la carte sort of thing. So yeah, super curious about the experiment you're running.
Well, and if, let's just say it doesn't go well, that leaves me with, I don't have just one option. The one obvious option is go back to the way it was. But I might want to think if there's a certain time of year that it goes down, maybe I need to think about what else I can do in that time to make that's a little bit different. And so I know a lot of teachers think about classes or groups or workshops or camps, so these are things that I've thought about doing. I have not done as of the time we're recording this, but that is, that is certainly an option, and it might be a nudge for me to do something like that. So, I think the thing that I have learned is that not everything has to be positive and negative. It's like you can learn from everything. And so, if I don't have the same amount of income in the summer, that doesn't have to be negative. That could just be an indication, just a nudge. Like, hey, let's do something different here, and which can be exciting. I think most of the times when we're trying something new, that's an opportunity to get excited about it. So just changing things up like that every so often.
For sure.
Okay, so let's talk about setting up as a business. I've got some talking points here, but I'm going to go a little out of order. Let's talk about doing business as, you know, so for way too long, and maybe I'm wrong about this. Maybe it was fine that I did this, but I just basically was me, David Lane, mm-hmm. the individual teaching so-and-so, getting a check payable to David Lane. Mm-hmm. And taxes come around and I filed as David Lane before I took another direction. So let's just talk about, is that okay to do that? Or should you register as a sole proprietorship or should you register as an LLC? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So most teachers start that way, you know?
Yes.
I didn't plan to start teaching when I started teaching. Someone asked me if I could. And so I said, sure. And that was the beginning of my business. So that's not an uncommon story. And a lot of teachers teach that way through their whole careers. So a little bit of background. So that the sole proprietor, by default, if you just start doing something and earning money with it, you are a sole proprietor. You don't have to do anything to be a sole proprietor. That's just what you are. That's how the IRS sees you. And I should preface this, I'm not a tax preparer or accountant or attorney or any of that. This is right. just me and my nerding out in tax tax code and business setup. So by default, you're a sole proprietor. You can register your business as an LLC. And the point of that is to put, it creates an entity for your business. So you are an entity, your person, and then your business is a separate entity, separate from you. And it puts kind of a legal boundary between you and your business. The idea being if someone were to sue your business, they would be suing just your business and not you personally and couldn't go after your personal assets, your house, your car, your savings, all of that, only the assets of the business. So that's the benefit to having an LLC. But LLCs are, you register the LLC with your Secretary of State, and it's not the same in every state the way it's handled. I live in Missouri, and it's, I want to say $115 to register an LLC one time, flat fee, that's it, $115. So it's almost a no-brainer here to do it right away. You don't have to have a lot of income to cover that. But other states like California, it's $800 a year to maintain an LLC. So, you know, when I've got a teacher that I'm working with who's based in California, they're starting out, they have three students and they're trying to build, but they've only got three students. I have a hard time recommending that they put $800 into forming an LLC right at the beginning. But it ultimately comes down to your comfort level with risk. So, you know, if you feel comfortable having those three students and being open to the risk of one of those three students suing you, then that's, you can make that choice. Some people feel comfortable with 50 students and still making that choice. So it's a comfort. There's a balance between the cost and the what's the risk that you're mitigating with that cost. But in a lot of states, it's pretty affordable. It's a one-time fee or a really low annual fee. And it's not even always a fee for maintaining the LLC. It's that having an LLC sometimes requires you to file certain tax forms, and those have a minimum payment with them. So it's not really the LLC maintenance, it's the filing of the specific tax form that is the annual cost. So, and it's, yeah, you just look at what it is in your state. If it's a low one-time fee, you probably do it sooner rather than later. But then you're striking that balance if you're in an area where the LLC is more to maintain.
Yeah, North Carolina's not as bad as California, but it's a lot more than Missouri.
Yeah, I'm really grateful for Missouri. It's just really business friendly. As far as taxes go, you're not by default taxed any differently if you're a sole proprietor mm-hmm. versus a standard LLC. Both when you file your taxes, we're going to get like really, really nerdy here, but you report your income and expenses on a Schedule C, mm-hmm. whether you're a sole proprietor or you have an LLC, it's reported the same way. So there's not actually any tax advantage to having an LLC. What people hear about is the S-Corp designation, which is, if you reach a certain threshold of income, you might switch your tax status to be taxed as an S corp, which comes with another set of things, which we can go into or not. But right. That's the only time it makes a difference, is if you are being taxed as an S corp through your LLC.
So talking about taxes, as an individual, I know that, you know, I have one W-2 part-time job, and everything else is all independent miscellaneous income that mm-hmm. I have to account for as far as taxes. And I certainly want to talk about that, paying taxes on that, in just a moment. But if I have an LLC, am I having to do two tax returns? Or how does that work for people when they get an LLC? When it comes to tax returns, do they have to do everything twice, or does it all stay the same pretty much?
Yeah. So your W-2 income is reported on one section of your 1040 is your overall tax return kind of summary page, and your W-2 income is reported on there. And then there are all these additional schedules, like the Schedule C for your business income. If you have multiple businesses, you might have multiple Schedule Cs. So you're not filing more than once. It's just multiple forms that get added to your that big envelope. Back in the day, we, you know, stuffed it all in an envelope, and it was heavier for self-employed people with multiple businesses. So if you have your teaching income as one, maybe you have that as an LLC, and then you might perform as an accompanist or with a band, and you might have a separate LLC for that. You could combine the two, or you might have a separate LLC or operate as a sole proprietor for the gig income, and that would just be a separate Schedule C.
Okay, yeah, because I've never been asked to file a tax return for, you know, for my business. You know, it's just, I mean, I have to, you know, re-register, or there's a thing with filing, but I still have some things to do. That's a 2024 goal as far as like getting everything into that. It's like, so I have it and so forth. But, you know, I still pretty much operate as an individual. It's just I have this LLC, and it's just kind of figuring out how to do that. So that's helpful for me as well.
Yeah. Well, and I should say for federal taxes, that's generally the way it goes, but you might have some state filing requirements mm-hmm. if you have, you're registered as an LLC. Here in Missouri, I don't. And I'm not sure about North Carolina, but when I lived in Maryland, it was a similar thing to California, where if you had an LLC, you had to file an annual report with the state tax office for each LLC. So it's a state by state guideline there. And that's where I say talk to your tax preparer, because every situation is just a little different. And
right.
You just, yeah.
Yeah.
Know so what applies to you and what doesn't.
So my LLC is kind of all inclusive. And, you know, this is kind of how I thought about it. It's just, people ask me, what do I do a lot? And, you know, mm-hmm. before I got an LLC, you know, it's just like, well, I compose and arrange here and there. I record some tracks for people who need them. I teach. I have a part-time church job.
What don't you do? Yeah.
It just kind of... So now you could say I'm the owner of David Lane Music, mm-hmm. you know, and I could talk about services that mm-hmm. it provides. And, you know, and I put under there, you know, including the Musician Toolkit podcast, you know, so mm-hmm. it's all of the things that I do, you know, that I don't get a W-2 for, it mm-hmm. all falls under David Lane Music. So that's just an idea. But of course, as you said, and we'll keep to the theme, there's no one way to do everything. You may want to consider an LLC for your different approaches. I think especially if you're using a different business name, like I have thought about, because at the moment, we're adding my wife as a violin and viola teacher onto my Fonz account, basically, and also going to my website. Well, I mean, I'm registered as David Lane Music, and it sounds a little weird. You know, I've got my wife, Jennifer, you know, under David Lane Music, but you know, it's less expensive than going to get a separate LLC for something like Lane Lessons. And I own a domain name for lanelessons.com. So I've got that I can do as a redirect, but it's not the official name. But if I ever did, you know, that would be something that I could consider, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, there you could file a DBA, which is just another legal name for your business. And then the LLC actually is the same. You keep your David Lane Music LLC, but you do business as Lane Music and you don't have to change that LLC. So that's an option there.
Okay, so if that happens this year, everyone will know it happened. Inspired by this episode. So let's talk about some. Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, and one more thing, because you said, like, do I lump it all together, or you've opted to lump it all together into one LLC? And I think that's totally fair and a legitimate way to do it. Something to consider if someone's trying to make that decision, like, do I set up multiple LLCs? It's again about the risk. Like, are you worried about someone suing you because you messed up their walking down the aisle song at their wedding? And if they were to sue you in that part of your business, do you want them also to have access to the teaching income and assets in your teaching business? So if you've got separate LLCs for each, major segment of your business, that keeps those things separate. But you have to keep records separately, like separate bank account for each LLC, separate set of books. So it's not a decision to be made lightly. Having just finished my taxes for this year, I had to file for or report for four LLCs, and it makes sense. I've got rental properties, and I want the liability of those separate from the liability of my teaching and all that. But it's not a decision to be made lightly.
Right. Yeah. If you live in Missouri, I'm sure it's a little easier with that flat rate and then the no annual fee. So, yeah, so that's seriously, that is a consideration of where you live. You know, like a little harder for Californians to have four LLCs, but I certainly get the point. Kind of wasn't what I was going to focus on today, but you know, since we talked about having an LLC, you know, some other questions that kind of come to mind is I like, do I need anything with that to make that legitimate? Like, do I need to go get checks with David Lane Music printed on it? Or for that matter, do you need a business bank account? Or are there other things that you, well, let's say it like this. Are there things you have to have, and are there things that are just a good idea to have?
Good question. I don't think there's anything you have to have. I can't think of anything, but there are a
Right.
lot of things that you should have that I almost consider have to have things.
Right.
One is an EIN, and that's the Federal Employer Identification Number. You don't have to be an employer to have that. And it acts as a social security number for your business. You can actually get this even if you are a sole proprietor. And I recommend that because, if you've got to give someone a W-9, I think that's, I'm getting my tax or
Yeah.
IRS forms mixed up. I think it's the W-9. If you're going to do, accompanying work or something, and someone's going to pay you as a contractor on that W-9, it'll require your social security number. It asks for a taxpayer identification number. And so if you're operating as a sole proprietor, you would usually put your social security number. But if you have an EIN, you can put that on there instead. And so it just kind of like, is a little better for personal security. So that's a good to have. And then the separate bank account, I would say if you're going to set up an LLC, this is as close to have to have as as possible, but the IRS doesn't stipulate it as far as I know. And again, even if you're operating as a sole proprietor, having a separate bank account, just it really illustrates that the business is separate from you. If someone were to sue you and you've got funds coming in through your personal accounts and some business accounts, or you don't have a business account, it's kind of hard to make the case that your business is actually separate from you. So having those separate business bank account versus personal, even if you have a sole proprietorship, it just makes it a stronger case that your business really is separate from you.
So let's talk about the fun topic that and I've appreciated. I think this is one of the first things I noticed about your podcast is that whether through your podcast or on social media, you always take time to point out it is time to pay your quarterly taxes. So I appreciate. I used those reminders for a while before I said, you know, why don't I just go ahead and like put a calendar event, you
Good
know.
job.
For some people, this is a new concept, and it's one that cost me a lot of money my first year teaching. tell us about quarterly taxes and what needs to be done as far as that goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the cost of being successful. I'm sorry that you had that experience your first year. It's not uncommon either. So if you're an employee at any place, your employer is, and if you receive W-2 income, your employer is withholding income from each of your checks and submitting it to the IRS throughout the year for your taxes. And that's why you get a tax return at the end of the year, because you've already given, paid those taxes. Or sorry, that's why you get a sometimes get a tax refund, often do. Mm-hmm. As a self-employed person, no one's taking that money out of your check for you. But the IRS still wants it. Right. So if you earn more than or expect to pay more than $1,000 in self-employment tax, you are required to file quarterly estimated tax, make quarterly estimated tax payments. And it's not hard to do. It's like a tiny little, if you file it by mail, it's a tiny paper that has like your name and maybe taxpayer identification number and the amount, and you just drop it in the mail with your envelope and off it goes. You can also file or pay online. So it's not a hard thing to do, but you are supposed to do it if you are going to owe more than $1,000 in taxes. And it's just what your employer would be doing if you were employed, but now you're your own employer, so you have to do it.
It only took the IRS about 25 years after the invention of the internet to allow online payments, but they finally did. They
did, yeah.
The thing I don't think that really got mentioned there, and maybe this has changed, but what was explained to me is that when you are a W-2 employee, you're only accounting for about half the taxes your employer is supplying the other half. But as an independent contractor, as a self-employed person, you are the employee and the employer, mm-hmm. and you are paying taxes on both ends, which makes the percentage like double.
That's what exactly it would normally right. be.
Yeah.
Now, so you're paying.
This is also a good time if you haven't. So if you're paying quarterly taxes, I didn't put this on my talking points, but I definitely should have. We should talk about deductions. So
those are way more fun.
Yes, these are much more fun. I had a really good accountant that just said, you need to just change the way you think. Every time you get in your car, just think, what might I be doing for my business today? Can I count for these miles? And every time you buy a meal, you know, you're saying to yourself, am I having this meal because I'm between lessons or I'm between gigs? So just your thoughts on deductions. What are some things? I mean, I mentioned a couple. Anything else that you think of that could, that people should think about?
Yeah, so much. Travel is one that I think a lot of teachers neglect, even if they, they might not be a travel teacher, so they just kind of assume it's not that significant. But I'm trying to remember what the mileage rate is this year. I want to say it's around 60 cents, like maybe it's either like 58.5 or 62.5. I can't remember exactly. But yeah, that's for every mile you drive, you get to write off that amount. So let's say you had 100 business miles over the course of the year at 62 cents a mile. So that's 62, we'll just say 60 cents or $60 that you get to write off. And that means you're not paying taxes on that $60. And at 15.3% for self-employment taxes, I'm trying to do mental math here. What is that? $9-ish?
Yeah.
That adds up, you know? I mean, $9 isn't a lot, but if you've driven 1,000 miles or, you know, and it's not a lot of work to keep those records. So that's a big one that even non-travel teachers, I think, should consider. If you drive to MTNA meetings or to a conference or recital venues, you know, all those things. Other ones, the home office deduction. If you teach out of your home, you can write off the space that you teach from. Any kind of music expense, if you're buying music for like your studio library, that can be music that just stays in your home, in your studio library, but that can be written off. your office supplies. I think a lot of teachers could have a whole line item in their budget for stickers. Those are for students. Recital expenses, if you book a venue or if you buy cookies. You mentioned the eating out for business versus personal. If you meet another teacher for coffee, the IRS has kind of clamped down on meals a little bit, and you used to be able to deduct 100% of a business business meal. Now it's 50% for something like a coffee meeting with another teacher. Right. But recital food, like if you're, you know, buying the cookies and punch for the recital, that is still 100% fully deductible for like event food.
I bought myself a new grand piano for Christmas, and I told my CPA, I bought it on December 31st, and I also bought a new computer for the studio this year. So I was like, how about we just kind of say that I paid for it on January 1st, and it's going to be a 2024 deduction, you know. But you know, those are things that you consider. Now I want to just throw a cautionary tale. Be careful, you know, it's easy to get carried away with not only deductions, but also, and I've met some teachers before, you know, off the record, who have said that, you know, sometimes if they get paid in cash and it stays cash, that they don't report that. And while that will make your tax return lower, it will also make you less desirable if you go apply for a loan, because they see that income as lower than it really is. And you can't then say, well, I just didn't report everything, or I used all these deductions. So there's a flip side to everything. So paying slightly higher on taxes and keeping up with it quarterly is probably a better solution overall than just trying to save as much as you can on taxes. And I think one rule that I've heard a lot of financial advisors say, that I suppose you would agree, is that if you get a large tax return, you are not doing it right. Would that be correct?
Yes. Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that about, like, don't not report the cash. And because, I mean, that's tax evasion is what that is. That's right. What we call it. When you're trying to avoid paying taxes that you actually are supposed to pay. So yeah, cash. And I can really say this makes an impact. I mentioned I have these rental properties, and I recently had a self-employed individual apply to live in one of my rental properties. And I'm like, yeah, self-employed person. You know, I can look at, I know what an unfamiliar tax return looks like, you know, because I have them. But there wasn't enough income reported. Like I didn't think this person could afford to pay the rent reliably on. And so, you know, I couldn't accept it. And so there are, don't be short-sighted.
Right.
Be honest, pay the taxes you're meant to pay. And there are checks and balances here. So yeah, do that. To your point about the, if you've gotten a tax refund, you've done it wrong.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. You want to get as close to that accurate number as possible. And there are a lot of ways to do that when you're doing your tax planning. You know, you can look at your income over the course of the year. And if you expect big fluctuations, early on, I used TurboTax to do my taxes, and I have switched to a tax preparer. But TurboTax would just say, what do you expect your income to be? 10% more, 20% more, 10% less? And it did a pretty good job estimating there. And you can do that manually as well. But if you're starting out and you might have 5 students in January and 25 students in December, your income is going to look really different. So what you estimated in April is not going to meet the needs of your December quarterly payments. So you can also just run a number for each quarter and say, well, this quarter I expect to owe this much in taxes for this income. And then next quarter, do that calculation again. And I have a tax calculator on my website that I can share. You could drop that in resources to kind of help get that number. Or again, a tax preparer, TurboTax, something like that is a great way to do that.
Sure. Now, one thing that I did not put this down when I made up my notes, but you dropped an episode on it recently, and it was episode 139, and who knows how long this will be relevant, but it's on the beneficial ownership information reporting requirement, or BOI for short. So this is something new this year. So if people already have an LLC, I would say that the episode's not very long. It was a 9-minute episode. So definitely don't take 9 minutes to explain it here, but maybe just summarize what that is.
Yeah, for sure. If you have an LLC, this is something you want to look at. And then if you have registered your business with your state in any way, this is something that might apply to you. Basically, it's the Treasury Department is trying to crack down on financial crimes. And so I don't think this happens in the music teacher world very much, but there's sometimes people hide behind LLCs, and you know, there might be an LLC nested in an LLC nested in an LLC, and it becomes kind of muddy who the actual owner is. So this is a report that you file to say who the owners are of the LLC or the registered business. So it's very easy to complete the report. I describe how it worked in that podcast episode. And that's basically what it is. The deadline for filing is December 31st, 2024, if you register your business before this calendar year, 2024. If you're registering your LLC or business during this year, you have 90 days to also do that. So it goes right along with that. Almost, it's like a new thing to add to the business startup checklist. File your LLC, do the BOI report. And then if you start your business in January 2025 or beyond, you're only going to have 30 days to file that BOI report. So it's not hard. There's no reason to put it off till December. Just get it taken care of.
Good. I'm thinking I'll probably wait till after April 15th, just just so I don't have like too many things. You mentioned a couple of hypotheticals that I would look forward to, you know, kind of, I would be amused to actually see. So one is someone getting sued, you know, because of a song that was played at their wedding. And then the other one is money laundering through, you know, private music teaching. I was like, I wonder if there's a novel in that or something. You know? I have so many things that on my notes that we will not get to. So I just want to cover just a couple, just real quick. You have a lot of coaching services, and you talk a lot about quarterly goals. I've also had an episode on quarterly goals, and I think you have a approach. It may not be unique, but it's the first time that I had heard about it before. You don't do a quarterly goal that starts with January, but it actually starts with February. Just briefly talk about your approach to quarterly goals.
Yeah. I think the word I would use to summarize my approach to goals is honesty.
Yes.
And that influenced starting my goals, my annual goals that start with that first quarter, February 1st, was just being honest that December was not the time to do the reflection part that I think you need, I need to do good goal setting. And I didn't like starting January feeling behind. I wanted to enjoy my holidays and then kind of regroup and start things in February. So yeah, honesty plays a big part in my goal setting philosophy. I do sort of more annual reflection in January and then map out maybe 10 to 12 things for the year that are big things that are going to move my business forward that I want to accomplish in that year. And then I back it down to what do I want to do in Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4. And then from there, and I think we might have talked about this offline at some point, I use a method based on the book, The 12-Week Year, which I think is one you talked about previously.
Yes.
Yeah. So then from once I have my quarterly goal, I put together a rough project plan for the quarter that kind of says, like, these are the top tactics that are required to get this goal done. So I'm not writing down every little thing. Like, I'm not writing down... set up the registration page on the website, set up the this week's social media post, take three pictures. I'm not writing down like every little tiny detailed thing. It's kind of the big benchmark kind of tactics. And I map those up for the quarter and assign them to a week that I want to accomplish them in. And when I do my goal setting, I'm looking like big picture. When do I need to have this done by so that I stay on track? for the quarter as a whole. And then each week I lift the tactics from those project plans and say, this is my work for this week, my strategic work for this week. And then I actually set aside different time in the week apart from my regular routines to do that strategic work. And it doesn't always stay on track. I have three little kids. Nothing stays on track.
Right.
But it always tells me like where I need to get back to reset. And it's kind of like, you know, you're on the highway and then you have to get off for some reason. And I can always see the on-ramp back to the highway. So it keeps me from like fumbling around. When I do get off track, I can get back on fixed.
And no one will notice except unless they watch the you know, the promo clips that go out for this episode, which will include the video. But right behind you are two clipboards. One says weekly plan and the other one says goals. So I like how that's right there for you to see.
Right there. Yeah. And during my strategic time, this is the only thing I do on paper. Everything else I do is digital. Mm-hmm. But I find I just have to really treat it differently. Mm-hmm. And so I have it on paper. I take that clipboard down. I put it on my desk. I do it when I'm setting up my week. I take both clipboards down. And then that's what I work from. So I can go somewhere else. I can be away from my computer even if my strategic work doesn't require a computer. But it just, I know I need to treat it differently. Otherwise, it gets lost in the shuffle of everyday, you know, maintenance tasks and interruptions.
All right. I'm going to let a lot of things go on my list here to, you know, talk about at another time. But there's something that, if memory serves me correctly, you mentioned on one of your podcast episodes. It was almost like a little PS at the end of an episode that I thought was really good. And maybe I'm completely remembering it wrong because I know I've heard this somewhere else. I heard this from, I know the podcast because it's one of the first ones I discovered when I was wanting to know more about business. It used to be called the Six Figure Home Studio. It's now the Six Figure Creative. And they have talked about following up. So this is just, you know, we talked about money. We haven't talked about like getting students, but I think you mentioned something about, and I wish I wrote down exactly what you said, but I think you even recommended a number, like how many times have you followed up? So just this idea of following, you have someone asking about lessons for their child. And I know so many people, this is a common story. I'll tell them information and then they say, oh, fine, I'll call you back. And then they don't call back. And I'm like, oh, I guess they didn't really want lessons. Moving on. But following up is a really important thing to a very important habit on our end to develop. So what are your thoughts on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Follow up is so much of it. I think of projects that I have not done just because the person I was working with didn't follow up with me, and like things I wanted to pay money for, you know, yes. House projects, or I've got a roof project right now for one of our rental properties that I could have moved on 2 months ago and no one ever followed up with me. And so it got to the bottom of my list. Follow up. So I say, you know, if you've got someone, those are precious. Those leads, like that's your, the work of your website and your reputation, those are precious things. So treat them as such, you know, they are your future business. So if someone calls you and you spend the time talking to them on the phone, get them in for a trial lesson, whatever your routines are around new prospects, call them the next day for sure. Call them the next day and reach out. And if they ignore you, call them again the next day. You know, I would do you have to weigh each situation, you know, and know if someone said, yeah, we're going to make a decision about this when we get back from vacation next week. Respect that. But I don't think it's out of line to follow up daily for a few days. And you might get the hint, but they should still go on even a semester follow up list. Like if you have five people that you just never heard back from in September, call them again in January. Maybe something disrupted their schedule in September that made them put a pause on piano lessons. But they might want to jump on again in January. And also, sometimes people are embarrassed that they dropped the ball.
Yeah.
And so don't assume it means that they're not interested. They might just be embarrassed and they might be starting their search over again just because they're embarrassed and you don't care. So just follow up with them, say, you know, I mean, there's no harm and you have no judgment against them for life getting in the way, someone getting sick, whatever. Don't be afraid of the follow-up.
I like the idea of two things. One, kind of a tapered follow-up system. So maybe, you know, multiple times in the first week, you know, maybe 2, 3, 4 times, whatever it is, mm-hmm. you know, and then maybe once a week for a few weeks, and then, you know, maybe once a month, mm-hmm. but it never like quite goes to zero. And this can be, you know, of course, people who asked about your services, but also people who said, I have to quit for a while. And if it's not someone, you know, that you're saying, oh, good, you know, that relationship wasn't working well anyway. If you enjoyed the experience and are kind of sad to see them go, you should check in. And this has been hard for me to do. Sometimes you check in and you find out, oh, we have a new teacher. Doesn't mean that you should dismiss the relationship. You know, maybe much less infrequently, you kind of check in. You know, just want to check how your education is going and, you know, make sure you're happy with, you could even be presumptive, happy with your teacher. And then you might get someone say, actually, well, that didn't work out. And we were thinking we should probably come back. Or, mm-hmm. you know, so there's, yeah. And I think a lot of it has to do with something like that is separating, well, not to take it personally. You know, it's like some people, for whatever reason, they might like you, but they want to try a different teacher or something like that. You know, you there doesn't have to be this, well, you know, I got snubbed, you know, I got rejected, mm-hmm. so I don't want mm-hmm. to come back. And that's, you know, thinking as a business, you know, it really helps in that regard.
Yes. And I think there's a lot of power in the personal, like, follow-up, like, hey, just checking in, thought about you, drove past your house this week, wonder how you're doing. That kind mm-hmm. of follow-up can be great. And also for the student that maybe it might feel too forward to do that with, like, you know, they went to study with a different teacher or something, and that might be inappropriate. a less personal follow-up, like if you've got a studio newsletter, even if it's not a regular studio newsletter, if you just send out some announcements, like a bulletin at the beginning of the semester, here's what I've got going on this summer. Now you've got this new tuition concept. You might, you know, email all your old students and just say, hey, you want to do a pickup lesson in July.
Yeah.
But you can do more generalized follow-up as well, just through an email list or text list or something.
And, you know, if you have a lot of contact, a variety of contact information, you could probably rotate it as well. Like you could mm-hmm. call them, or you could text them, or you could email them, or send them a Facebook message or something like that.
Yes. Yeah, and that's especially true for those first follow-ups when you're like really trying to get in touch with someone, because you can actually contact them multiple times in one day, like call them, leave a voicemail, and then 5 minutes later or immediately text them right afterwards. Just say, just left you a voicemail, and so they know you're really, really serious about it. And you're not being annoying. Right. I think of it, like, you really are being helpful. I would love for this roof project to be moving along, and I just, no one has forced me to do it. So right. It's not on my goal list right now. It's no roofs are leaking. It's just a
right. precaution. And I think the thing to also keep in mind is, you know, just people just get, we all get distracted. I mean, so many things come up in the day and it derails what we had in mind. And then you, like you said, there may be an embarrassment factor. It's like, well, I mean, I haven't called them back and it's been 2 weeks. And in once at a certain point, it just becomes easier to do nothing than to mm-hmm. now take that step. So you actually make it easier, you know, when you're following it. This has been a hard lesson for me to learn because I'm kind of shy, introverted, and, you know, don't want to. Last thing I want to do is be imposing. I'm one of those people that I get so anxious in traffic if I feel like I'm holding somebody up, or, you know, like it's just one of those things. I just hate to be the inconvenience, but had to kind of accept I'm actually being more convenient, you know, in this regard, if I just take time to follow up and increasing the odds of success. Yeah, I've heard there are numbers out there, and who knows, like, how accurate the studies are, but sometimes you'll hear things like average person requires 9 follow-ups, or they require 12 follow-ups, or I've heard the number 17, you know. Someone said people have to hear about an event 17 times before they remember. That was what someone mm-hmm. said one time in a meeting. But, to me, the numbers in this case is less important than just the habit of frequency and just doing that. Mm-hmm. So,
and something else that I've recommended teachers do when they do feel uncomfortable or feel like they're imposing, one of your follow-ups can be, hey, I know you're busy, so when would be a good time for me to follow up? And they say, or you can even ask this at the end of a trial lesson, when do you think you'll be making this decision by? And then they say Friday, and you follow up on Friday. And then, you know, you might follow up every day after Friday, and then on Monday you still haven't heard from them, and you say, do you need a little more time to make the decision? Like, just try to get them to engage. It's ghosting is the hardest thing when you get nothing from them. Right. But if you can ask a question that gets them to engage and give you a timeline and just say, no pressure, just let me know when you'd like me to follow up. And that makes it a little more gentle.
Yeah, that's such a powerful mm-hmm. thing. So I'm glad that we talked about that. All right. So again, so many things that we could talk about, but you talk about a lot of the things, you know, that we didn't. So I would also encourage people to check out your podcast. Now you have some interviews, and you also have a lot of very short, handy solo episodes. So this is at Music Studio Startup. Anything else you want to say about the podcast, and also where can people follow you and find more information?
Yeah. Thank you for that. And thanks for the episodes you mentioned, highlighting those. Yeah, I talk about the business side of teaching almost exclusively. Sometimes we get into pedagogy, but not very often or not very deeply. So right. I appreciate all your goals on your episodes on that too. MusicStudioStartup.com is where my website is, and the podcast is by the same name. We're on Instagram. You're talking about follow up, and I think follow through is a big thing on goals, and we follow up on our weekly tactics and all of those things, and that's what makes goals happen, and that's what my hub is all about. My hub and membership. So we have a hub and mastermind program, and it's just this. It's the accountability. It's teachers coming together who are determined to reach their goals and want that weekly accountability of, I'm going to check in on my goals. I'm going to see if I did a thing or didn't do a thing. We're going to help each other get unstuck. And that's all. You can find all that at musicstudiostartup.com as well.
Okay. So one last question. I'm going to ask you to just persuade me of something real quick. So we obviously, we met at NAMM, and I was there actually because I was volunteering for an event that ended up getting canceled. but the perk was we got a free admission for NAMM, you know, and I still had to pay for all the airfare and the travel. I've also been a member of MTNA for a few years, and so I have not been back to NAMM, and I have not ever been to an MTNA conference. I've been to our state conference, mm-hmm. you know, NCMTA. Mainly because I'm on the board of directors for that conference, but I've never been to MTNA, and I know that you frequently show up at both events. I'll just go and throw it out there. Those are expensive events, especially when you, not just for the registration, but because the NAMM registration is actually fairly cheap, but when you consider the travel and, mm-hmm. and all of that, what are the benefits as far as you can see for attending either of those events?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just thinking this morning about the expense of MTNA and conferences, and would love to find ways to reduce that. You know, there are some scholarships available and things like that, but they're not insignificant. And I practice strategies to help save money and make the travel as inexpensive as I can. But benefits. One of the benefits for me is that it's a break, you know, it's different. Mm-hmm. It's being around people who are excited to teach and run their businesses, but we're not teaching or running our businesses while we're there. And so it's really refreshing in that. And the presenters are people who are living this stuff day in, day out, and like all the best ideas. You know, you jump from one session to another where it might be something you've never thought about, but just little tidbits often I'll get, like, oh, here's another off the bench game I can do with my 4-year-old student, or It's just so many ideas. So lots of ideas. Again, then I go back to that first point of know what business you're trying to build so you can filter everything out and take back what you want to implement and be okay letting other things go. But yeah, I think it's the just tremendous number of ideas and the break and then networking, getting to meet other teachers and have people that you can ask questions of.
I probably might regret not doing it this year just because it's a 5-hour drive away. But as opposed to last year when it was in Reno, and that was, you know, definitely a
Reno
flight.
Was a challenge. Yeah.
But yeah, Atlanta's much, much closer. But anyway, well, have a good time there. And maybe in the future, I'll see you there. I don't know about NAMM and so forth. Now, NAMM, you work for a music store. So there's kind of a, that's also ties into that, I imagine.
And I think I've only been to two NAMMs. And I can see that they're trying to make an effort for music teachers and more the, like, that part of education. I think they've had a big emphasis on, like, school music teacher kind of tracks in their conference programming, but the music teacher, like independent music teacher part, isn't super well developed. And if someone is trying to decide between the two, I think it's MTNA is a pretty easy choice between the two. My
Excellent.
Opinion.
Great. Well, I'll have to keep that in mind, especially, you know, for future years. So yeah, it's about to happen as we're speaking. So, and I would have loved to, you know, I know like Tim Topham's the keynote speaker, so that would be very nice to hear him in person.
Yeah. It's fun to see everyone. It's kind of like going to summer camp, you know, with all your music teacher friends.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Yeah, David, this was so fun. Thank you for having me.
And that is going to wrap up episode number 69. By the way, this conversation was recorded about 3 weeks earlier from the time that I'm recording this this outro, and some of that information is already outdated. And what I mean is specifically the part about experimenting with my new payment system that I was talking about and giving it the rest of the year. Well, you know, since Andrea and I talked, I've had enough data to show that the new way that I tried really is not working as much as the old way was. So I may elaborate more on this later, but there will be a change to my studio policy, and it will happen before the end of 2024. So more on that later. All of the other information in this episode is still up to date. Do check out Andrea's resources, including her podcast. The link for Music Studio Startup, which includes all of that, is in the show notes. Please share this episode with anyone that you think might be interested. And also, please share with me privately if you want more or fewer episodes like this. Again, that's going to wrap it up for today. I will be back with you again next week. Until then, thank you so much for listening.